Tune to 99.5 FM WBAI, WBAI.org on the web. Coming up next, Clearing the Fog.
They were saying when they think you cannot hear. If you understood what they do, if for you it was so clear. If you knew they shut down the factory in an economic ruse. If you could kiss the cheek of the child in the sweatshop that made your shoes. Every time we went to war to fight our evil foes, they told you we were really fighting for the good of CEOs. If you could feel the hunger of the many, see the riches of the few. If they told it like it is, what if you knew?
You're listening to Clearing the Fog, speaking truth to expose the forces of greed on Pacifica Radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. I'm Margaret Flowers. This week I interviewed Patty Naylor. Patty is a farmer and a member of the U.S. Food Sovereignty Alliance, and she talks about the corporatization of the global food system and the upcoming United Nations Food Systems Summit, which the major organizations worldwide that represent those who produce food are boycotting. So stick around for that interview. But before I get to that, I'm going to talk about some things that are in the news. And I'll start with a COVID-19 update. The United States now has around 42 million documented cases of COVID-19 and more than 678,000 deaths. The good news, I guess, is that the number of cases is starting to fall off again, although it's still very high. But there's concern about a fifth wave coming this fall with the reopening of schools, the growing number of cases among children, and the holiday travel coming up, and looking at how in 2020, when despite recommendations not to travel, many people still did during the holidays. There is a report by the Commonwealth Fund. This has been going on since 2004, this annual report looking at how the United States ranks on healthcare compared to other wealthy nations. And maybe no surprise that the United States ranked dead last, despite the fact that the United States spends much more per person per year on healthcare. This report found that 50% of people with lower incomes and 25% of people with high incomes report that the cost of healthcare has prevented them from receiving care that they need. And another report shows that the United States is falling to last place in vaccinating the population against COVID-19 among the wealthy nations. So the U.S. came out fairly strong initially, but as other countries geared up their vaccination programs, they began to quickly outpace the United States. And this is really, I think, a consequence of not having a universal healthcare system, and really points to the need in the U.S. for a national improved Medicare for All healthcare system. That's the solution to our healthcare crisis, and the lack of that has put us at a real disadvantage during this pandemic. And so if there was ever a time for us to fight for national improved Medicare for All, now is that time. President Biden last week made his speech, you know, the mandate that workers become vaccinated. Already, you know, if you look at the working population, that's where we see our highest rates of vaccination. So is this really going to make a big difference? That's not clear, but I think it's important to realize that putting so much emphasis on vaccination and really losing focus and losing investment into the other parts of our public health care system, I think, is really going to be a problem for us in the United States. Being vaccinated does not necessarily protect you from getting COVID-19, does not stop you from spreading the illness, the immunity wanes. So, you know, vaccinations are important. They do help to some extent, and particularly helping in preventing deaths and hospitalization, but it's not stopping the spread of the disease. You know, we need to be putting more attention to testing, tracing, and isolating contacts, to giving people the supports that they need to be able to protect themselves, have economic security, food, shelter, so that people can quarantine when they need to. Over this weekend, the Sanctions Kill Coalition, of which I am a member, released its new report. There was a webinar held on Sunday night. This is a report that responds to President Biden's executive order. I think it was his first executive order as president, where he said that he wanted the United States to look at the sanctions imposed on countries around the world and whether they unduly hinder their response to COVID-19. Now, nobody expects the Biden administration to actually do a fair assessment of the result of the United States' economic war against 39 countries, or about a third of the global population. And so the Sanctions Kill Coalition decided to do our own report. Look for that report at sanctionskill.org. So I'll stop there. I want to bring you another segment by Paul Tulloch, another fog clearer. So take it away, Paul.
Greetings, I'm Paul Tulloch. This week on Clearing the Fog, we will look at the politics of climate change. This in response to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report that was released earlier this month. The report concluded that we must have massive reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, or the planet will continue to warm past the projected 1.5 degrees Celsius mark, unleashing massive environmental disasters, the likes of which could threaten life itself on the planet. As mentioned last week, the solutions to climate change lay in three major realms: the scientific, the economic, and the political. In November, the world's leaders will meet at COP26 and discuss the IPCC findings. The question facing policymakers will focus on action and policy changes required to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. I'm pretty sure you will not hear much of the following discussed at this meeting. These leaders will look at the science, they will assess the economic costs, but they will need to take a very deep dive into the political to generate the actions we need. Let's hope they do, given the voices around the world have been calling COP26 the last great chance to save the planet from runaway climate change. But I'm not optimistic. Essentially, without some core changes in the capitalist neoliberal design global economy, we will not see the actions needed. These changes will mean a large transfer of power between wealthy elites and their corporate boards to the governments and other nonprofit organizations at the international and national level across the planet. Instead, we will most likely see more half measures, more deflection, more delays. We'll hear a lot about the new potentials for some far-off technological solution, a whole lot of carbon capture technology, which is funded and supported by the oil and gas sector, but not much will be said about changing the core functioning of the status quo of capitalism, as it will mean essentially changing the power relations at the highest level. So essentially, my conclusion for the future: change the system before climate change changes it for you. So to get to that conclusion, let's start by developing a critical perspective of the politics of climate change. At the head of the list for change are a very small, powerful group of individuals who own a massive infrastructure of productive and financial assets across the globe that maintain their wealth through a hefty flow of profits. And these profits sit upon fossil fuel, which powers up the machinery, the factories, and the global distribution networks. Second, we have bubbles of middle-class population that dot the nations of the first world, who are embedded in a culture of consumerism and are not only dependent but have become indoctrinated to demand an increased standard of living. This set upon two-thirds of the world in less developed parts, where the focal point of daily life for a majority of the population is producing a subsistence level of living which far outweigh any concerns for greenhouse gas emissions. This distribution of wealth between the rich and the poor have been built upon centuries of imperialism and wealth accumulation, technological development, and repression of workers' rights, witnessed by massive investment into the culture of information, propaganda, and ideological underpinnings. And when these fail, the military war machines of the world ensure the status quo remains committed to the profit-maximizing potential of investment owned by the few. And all this sit atop an energy source that has become reliant on fossil fuel and its greenhouse gas emissions. That industry has been protected and expanded with a belief that cheap and secure oil has become the harbinger of capitalistic success. Cheap fossil fuel means many things for profit, with transportation of goods seeking lower costs become accessible and possible, expanding the profit abilities massively of the global value chains, where conception, design, raw material collection, production, marketing, and distribution within one organization can occur for a product, circle the planet, and still be extremely profitable. Greenhouse gas emissions are nowhere measured or accounted for. On top of that value chain of capitalist production, we have a massive oil and gas sector that has become embedded within the political economy of the world, in which huge amounts of wealth have been generated for specific nations and their wealthy elites. Many vested interests have lobbied and secured their privilege within the decision-making apparatus of governments right across the planet that it will take a huge effort to detach such from the era of fossil fuel politics and the autocratic structures it has created. We still have not been able to stop wars within many of these nations and regions where oil wealth and protecting its pricing mechanisms and supply flows, let alone regulating its decline. How will the ratcheting down of the fossil industries occur? We've seen it play out time and time again, where massive oil infrastructure is built using scarce government resources as subsidies for the sector. We've not even been able to stop the billions of fossil fuel subsidies handed out by government, let alone have the government effectively regulate and bring an end to fossil. The political field is littered with middlemen, corporate lobbyists, and governments who generate revenues from the sale of fossil fuels. It is a complex space to think that just because it makes sense for the world to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, it will occur. So we can talk, as we did, about the scientific need to change. We can discuss the economic aspects of change, but none of this will matter without action, and that comes from the political changes needed, which has been blocking action on climate change for decades. If the discussions at COP26 remain guided by the IPCC conclusions in its major report, that rising greenhouse gas emissions are caused, quote, is likely due in part to inadequate awareness of the multiple benefits of emission reductions. Additionally, a lack of adequate policies, institutional structures, and governance play important roles, end quote. The naivety displayed in this statement is problematic on so many levels, I'm not even sure where to begin. To conclude that awareness is a key causality behind the inaction of climate change for many decades is quite irresponsible. So the question remains, what kind of policy should COP26 policymakers be focused on that will be needed to change capitalism and its functioning at the global and national level? The first goal and most critical is to empower governments to be able to regulate and make effective policy rules to curtail greenhouse gas emissions. Since the rise of neoliberalism and the austerity rules for balanced budgets and tax cutting has effectively reduced the role of governments to crossing guards. Governments have increasingly been pushed out of decision-making and the public good has been cut back and privatized where profits could be made. Instead of crossing guards, climate change policy needs governments to emphasize greenhouse gas emission reduction instead of profits on a large proportion of the private sector. This, of course, will require a huge transformation of decision-making and regulation power into the hands of government. This is where the problem of the political arises. With the rise of neoliberalism, we witnessed the destruction of government's ability to run deficits and spending. Whether it be allocating investment into building public services or the expansion of social programs, all were pulled back and cut under the massive assault of austerity, the goal of which was to reduce the regulatory powers of government to effectively regulate the corporate and the wealthy elite. If the goal is to change the functional aspects of a large proportion of value adding within the economy to become fossil free, and a majority of that investment, more than 70% of it, is owned by private interests in the first world nations, then it will take some very strong policy to make those changes. But how can we transition a political space that has such power hierarchy and resources? We've been trying for two decades with market forces to change the system and reduce greenhouse gas emissions. As Carl Polanyi wrote in his most famous book, The Great Transformation, market forces are fictitious. Self-regulated markets will always fail to protect society from the most destructive aspects of market forces, as these are essentially rulemaking by rulers who are seeking to maximize profit. Over the past 30 years of neoliberalism, greenhouse gases have been on the rise, and as mentioned last week, mainly due to the fact that when we make profit, the formula for it does not include any accounting for greenhouse gases. Instead, we are faced with a situation where billionaires are appointed daily with increasing numbers as wealth inequity climbs. And instead of investment into greenhouse gas emission and reductions, we have billionaires building spaceships to escape the planet. What we need are dramatic changes in the power relations between the corporate world and the public interest, a shift from purely profit-driven investment into greenhouse gas reduction-induced investment. This will mean a lot of change and be met with the resistance on both sides of the political tracks. We will also experience political resistance from the consumer bases of the first world, who have enjoyed an unprecedented freedom to consume, far surpassing any point in history in terms of cultural norms of consumption levels. We will need a political and cultural shift within some spaces that will be very difficult. As witnessed with the struggles of COVID-19, convincing significant proportions of populations to even get a vaccine to save their life, convincing proportions of the population to give up greenhouse gas intensive lifestyle will be very difficult. It will be a political battle on many levels. However, the cost for these changes cannot be just dumped onto the population in which are least able to pay for such costs, which is always the way when market-based solutions are used. In finding political solutions, we must go backwards in history to the investments used to wage war and produce destruction that World War II unleashed onto the landscape of humanity, and also the rebuilding of the economies from that war. It is within that space we will find global solutions, just like the past did in building the present. The reality we face is now deterministic on the decisions we make right now. If we do not make the investments in a way that will change the system, then climate change will change the system for us.
Thank you for that report, Paul. We'll now take a short musical break and come back with the interview with Patty Naylor.
We are a flexible and innovative species, and we have the capacity to adapt and modify our behavior. Now, we most certainly have to do so if we're to deal with climate change. It's the biggest challenge we have yet faced.
The same thing that keeps the earth warm.
You're listening to Clearing the Fog, speaking truth to expose the forces of greed on listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. I'm Margaret Flowers. And now I turn to my guest, Patty Naylor. Patty is a farmer in Iowa. She has a family farm with her husband, George. She's on the board of Family Farm Defenders, a member of the National Family Farm Coalition and the U.S. Food Sovereignty Alliance, also the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. She focuses on agroecology and food sovereignty. Thank you so much for taking time to join me, Patty.
And thank you, Margaret.
So I wanted to talk with you, to start out with talking about the United Nations Food Summit 2021 that's coming up. There's a lot of resistance to that, complaints about corporate control. Can you talk a little bit about that food summit?
Yes. The food summit will be on September 23rd. It will be virtual, and the agenda has already been pretty well set. It'll be rather a formal agenda because it was first decided to have this food system summit in the summer of 2019. It was the World Economic Forum and the Gates Foundation who came up with this idea. And so they have been at least behind the scenes more in control of what's happening. So in the past 2 years, then, it's been building up to this. And fairly quickly, civil society realized there would be concerns about transparency, about inclusiveness, about basing the outcomes on human rights and accountability. And we were concerned, of course, about corporate capture of our food system. So fairly quickly, we realized that there'd be some problems or concerns that we wanted to pay attention to. One of them was that the special envoy who was appointed to oversee this food system summit is a woman from Africa named Agnes Kalabati. She works for the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa, which is a Gates Foundation-funded organization that promotes things like genetically engineered seeds and chemical herbicides, pesticides that go against the ideas of agroecology that so many peasants, farmers, and rural workers in Africa and in other countries focus on. So there were some real concerns right away.
I understand that this summit differs from past summits in that in the past, it was actually organizations more connected to the food producers, not the corporate ones. But, the overwhelming majority of our food is produced by local smaller farmers. Are you able to talk a little bit about how this is different?
Yes, I'd be happy to. I'd like to tell your audience about the Committee on World Food Security. That's where previous World Food Summits have come out of. The Committee on World Food Security is an intergovernment agency that was formed in 1974 to focus on hunger, malnutrition, and food insecurity around the world. They did have hosted a food summit at that time in 1974. And again, in 1996, the Committee on World Food Security hosted a World Food Summit. So this one is not coming out of the Committee on World Food Security and is not coming out of the Rome-based agencies, which focus us on food and agriculture. A little bit more than about the Committee on World Food Security. After the food crisis of 2008 and 2009, there was calls for the Committee on World Food Security to reform. And much of that inspiration came from civil society and social movements around the world, including farmers, peasants, those who are actually producers of food, and especially La Via Campesina. So in 2010, the CFS, as it's called, was reformed, and it is now considered to be the foremost inclusive, intergovernmental, and international political platform on food security and nutrition. And it explicitly has a vision to foster the progressive realization of the right to adequate food for all. So civil society has a place at the table, a seat at the table. The member states of the committee have voting rights, but the participants in the negotiations, the processes, the mechanisms that govern and follow through of the CFS guidelines and documents and research that comes out of that, the civil society has a mandated place to be there at these kind of negotiations and processes alongside the private sector, philanthropic foundations, and other UN agencies like the World Bank. So we have a place there at the Committee on World Food Security, and we have used that to get into the documents of the CFS language on human rights, including UNDROP, which is the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Peasants and Other Rural Workers, and also the UNDRIP, which is the United Nations Declaration on the Right of Indigenous Peoples. And we also make sure that there's language of human rights on relating to women and youth. So it's a very important space for us to be in. Civil society mechanism, the full title of it is the Civil Society and Indigenous Peoples Mechanism, is very well organized. It's an inclusive, open entity. We welcome any organizations that work on food, food production, and food security. And I am the focal point of the sub-region of North America, which includes United States and Canada. So we have regular meetings, phone calls to discuss the things that are happening and to share with each other what our insights are. So it's a very important space to be in.
Right. So the past meetings kind of came out of that Committee on World Food Security and the Food and Agriculture Organization. But this time it's really being driven by, as you said, the World Economic Forum, the, you know, global wealthy elite, and the Gates Foundation, which has been so responsible for undermining local producers in Africa, doing land grabs and pushing their products into Africa and undermining the traditional practices used there for agriculture. Can you talk a little bit about kind of the growing corporate control of the food supply globally? I mean, it's surprising to me that the corporations have so much control, but they don't produce very much. I think people would be surprised to learn that. Are you able to talk about that corporatization of agriculture and the impact that that's had on farmers and the food supply?
Certainly. What I see here in Iowa is an increasing influence of corporations. Farmers here have to work underneath the free market system, the neoliberal ideology of free markets around the world, which means that the prices that we get are determined on a global scale. And corporations are the buyers of farm products on the most part. They buy corn, soybeans, wheat, rice, and those are the commodities that are storable. So they control that on a global scale, the supply, the demand. We also have, of course, the seeds that are patented, genetically modified seeds. So what I see here in Iowa is farmers are, in a sense, stuck in this kind of treadmill of only growing conventional corn and soybeans and using synthetic fertilizers and harmful chemical pesticides. And a really concerning thing is that livestock is now in confinements instead of being on the land. This is in stark contrast to what is considered much more resilient, sustainable, climate-friendly agriculture that we would consider agroecology, which is the focus of many peasants and farmers from around the world. I was at a meeting about a year ago with a CEO of our farmer member cooperative, which markets corn and soybeans for the conventional farmers here. And his idea of the future of agriculture, and he thought this was a positive thing, was that in the near future, a farmer's data is going to be more valuable than the crop that they grow. I find that very, very concerning, because why would that be? And what does it mean for the farmer? It means all of the knowledge that a farmer has of what seeds he wants to plant, what the weather is doing, the conditions of his soil, and then the yield that he gets in his harvest, his or her, I should say, is being collected by technology. And this is being purchased by corporations like Monsanto, John Deere, any of the corporations that can benefit from having that data. And to think that that information is more valuable than the food that's being grown does not sit well with me, I would say. And I think in the future, it means that the farmer's knowledge is going to be controlled by corporations. And in fact, it means that farmers can easily be replaced by corporations. And this is what we're talking about when we say corporate capture of this UN food system. So what does that mean for the individual person? Here in the United States, we have relatively cheap food. And this cheap food policy means that the farmers here in the United States or wherever they are in the world need to compete with each other to grow food at the lowest price possible. So that means they're not taking into consideration environmental, cultural, social benefits of farming, the common good that farming provides. So these are real concerns about what the corporate capture means. It means what kinds of food people will be eating, how that food will be delivered to us, processed, delivered, transported around the world. And then, of course, they're monocrops. We have here in Iowa, it's corn and soybeans. In other parts of the world, we have palm oil plantations, which are devastating rainforests. In South America, corn and soybeans and wheat, I believe, are taking the place of local foods. So to think that the corporations who are there to be accountable to their stakeholders and to make a profit, to think that they are going to be in charge of our food system and our production system is very, very concerning. It means that people around the world are being pushed off their land. We talk about concerns about migrants wanting to come to the United States, coming across our borders. It's the trade agreements and the monocropping that's happening in other countries that's pushing farmers off the land in their countries. Also, it's not just the production side. During the pandemic, in the last year and a half, there's been huge disruptions in how local farmers can get their products to their local markets. And even if the local markets are being allowed to be continued to be open, I know that in some parts of Eastern Europe, I heard reports about how people are told that they need to shop at supermarkets because that's where the food is safe, rather than at the local markets where food is not as safe. And so they've closed down local markets and people are beginning to buy supermarket food, which is processed, ultra processed in many ways. So those are concerns all across the globe of the influence of corporations on our food system.
Right. And as you pointed out, what I think is so important to underscore is that those corporations don't have the concerns of the people. They're not trying to make sure that everybody is getting, you know, adequate food, healthy food. It's all about profits, and that kind of the processing, you know, pushing processed food on people's is also, you know, tied into the health issues and the problems with obesity and with people, you know, having a lot of health problems. So it's all like going against our actual interests. That makes me think, when I think of the United Nations Food System Summit, it makes me think of the United Nations Conference of Parties or the climate meetings, because over the years, those have really been captured by the corporations as well that are just trying to profit off of the climate crisis. And the voices of people who are directly impacted, who are pushing for real solutions, are being marginalized in those talks as well. So it's disappointing to hear the United Nations is doing this. Now, there was a counter summit in July, People's Counter Summit. Can you talk about that?
Yes, the UN Food System Summit had a official pre-summit event in Rome in July. And so as the civil society and other organizations, our allies around the world, including environmental organizations, human rights organizations, those concerned about, like you say, climate change, we came together and had a virtual event, very, very successful, I think. It was amazing to watch the videos that were sent to the day we had a rally We had videos from peasants and organizations from around the world. It was just inspiring to see all of the things that people are doing. It was kind of a combination. Here are the answers. Here's the way that we can produce food in a sustainable, agroecological, organic way that supports farmers, supports communities, provides healthy food. And at the same time, here on this side is our political statements about why this food system summit and the corporate capture of our food system is so concerning and why we're speaking out against that. So it was a very, very inspiring, uplifting, and yet sobering event. And it reached thousands of people as the event was online and through social media. It was passed around, shared by many people.
And that's so important to have those types of formations happening outside of that corporate captured structure. So the Food Summit is going to be taking place in New York coming up actually very soon. Can you talk about, there is a call to boycott that meeting. What type of resistance is going to be going on around that?
Thank you. A lot of the resistance has already happened in the sense that the civil society decided very early on that they did not want to participate in this food system summit. Many people were approached to participate in various action tracks and dialogues of this food system summit that's been leading up to this. So some people in that we know through our organizations have been on the inside of the summit process. But civil society, La Via Campesina, and many others from around the world have said no. We had discussions, we had negotiations, we set our red lines. If the Food System Summit can do this, if they can have an action track on human rights, we could join, but that didn't happen. So the decision was made that we will not be a part of this. And in fact, we are speaking out against it. So on September 23rd, the National Family Farm Coalition will be having an online event. And we have several things scheduled for about a half of a day event. So that registration will be coming out soon. And other people are speaking out against the Food System Summit. U.S. Food Sovereignty Alliance will be having some social media outreach on that. I will mention, though, that those who are on the inside of the Food System Summit, those who have been trying to influence the summit outcomes from the inside, have been somewhat successful, too. And I would say that the counter-mobilization has been somewhat successful as well, in the sense that we have brought out a lot of awareness, and the Food System Summit is somewhat co-opting our language. They've got more language within their documentation about human rights, but we don't believe it's going to be nearly enough. One of the people who is on the inside is the current special rapporteur on the right to food. His name is Michael Fakhry. And he's a very good ally of us. He put out a policy brief just last month. And I'd like to read the first paragraph of his policy brief, if you don't mind. It says, climate change is ravaging the planet. Biodiversity diminishes every day. Hunger is on the rise. Inequality is incessant. Global food systems have been failing most people for a long time. And the COVID-19 pandemic has made a critical situation even worse. People are already transforming their food systems to adapt and survive. Now is the moment to globally coordinate people's actions for building equitable and flourishing food systems. But then he does go on to say that he's not confident that this summit will actually accomplish those things.
Right. It sounds like the summit is doing the opposite of that and driving practices that are actually harmful to, like we said, climate and the people's health. I just wanted to mention that La Via Campesina, if people aren't familiar with that, is kind of it's an international organization of peasant farmers. And then I think I understand the World Forum of Fisher People is another very large global group that's been leading the resistance to this food summit as well. Now, La Via Campesina came out of Nicaragua. Nicaragua is a country that has really demonstrated and is demonstrating, it's still, you know, it's an ongoing process, what it actually means to create food sovereignty and use agroecological processes. I understand that you traveled to Nicaragua. Can you talk about the importance of, you know, why are food sovereignty and agroecology important?
Yes, I've been to Nicaragua twice in the last 5 years. And each time I've been there, we visited farmers, and they do promote agroecology as a way to resist the influence of industrial agriculture, the corporations. They know that industrial agriculture, corporate dominated, genetically modified seeds, pesticides would destroy their local farmers. Nicaragua is a very stable country right now. They have very strong organizations on the countryside to support women and youth and farmers. They have cooperatives. They work together. They also have agroecology schools where they teach young people not just the practices of agroecology, but also political education to understand why we have the system that we have, that is the global system of industrial agriculture, and how to resist that. And I think that is very, very important. Food sovereignty is something that every country should be able to realize. With the trade agreements that we have through the WTO and also the power of the exporting countries, including the United States, and those kind of influences, it's very difficult for any country to really, truly decide what their food system should look like and support their own farmers. Nicaragua is doing a fantastic job of supporting their own farmers, and they provide much of the food that their people eat. And I think this is a wonderful example of what needs to be done in other parts of the world. Here in the United States, most of us are so disconnected to our food system, to agriculture. We don't really understand when we go to the grocery store where all that food came from, and most people don't seem to even think about it. But in fact, the global food system goes through a huge long line of chain, of food supply chain that goes through from the producer to the processors to transportation and to manufacturing and finally to your grocery store. And I think it's very concerning that we're no longer connected to the land. I grew up on a farm, and I'm farming again now after being away from the farm for a number of years. And I find it's so very important to know how the seasons change, and watching the weather and the sun come up and the sun go down and all of the things that make up how nature works for us and how we need to protect nature to be able to provide the food that sustains us healthfully for the future. I think the idea that, and this is a little bit off track, but the idea that we can pay farmers now for ecosystem services is a wrong idea, because we're looking at ecosystem services, that is the soil and the water and the sunshine, those things that we should be protecting rather than taking from them. That's what we really should be looking at. And that's why, like, the people in Nicaragua who are so close to the land, they understand those cycles. I think that's something that I find very, very, very inspiring and hopeful when I see the farmers of countries like Nicaragua and others around the world who understand how we need to take care of the land, take care of nature, and not dominate nature.
Right. And, you know, that when they had the Sandinista Revolution beginning in the 1970s, they recognized that food sovereignty was going to be an important part of that revolution for a number of reasons. Organizing the rural workers was critical to building that base. But they also knew that they were going to need to feed themselves to be able to get through that revolution. And so that's been a kind of a core part of Nicaraguan society now for many decades. And I was there as well in March of this year to visit some of those farms and learn, you know, firsthand also how they're trying to really make an effort to understand and record indigenous agricultural knowledge and to, you know, marry that with the new technology and, you know, new discoveries that they have, all with the intention of creating, you know, more democratized, healthier, more resilient food system, which is also going to be so important as we see the climate crisis, you know, and the pandemic have really shown us how these major systems can break down you know, in the face of a crisis. And food is one of those necessities that we need to make sure we can still get, you know, when there's a crisis going on. Now, you've changed, I understand, the practices at your farm. Are you able to talk a little bit about kind of how your farm, how you've started to incorporate some of these ideas into your own farm?
Sure. We are on, I would say, on a path to agroecology. We're not there yet. But we did transition our farm that had been non-GMO corn and soybeans to organic production. We still grow crops of corn and soybeans. And I've also added oats and hay to that. Just yesterday, we sent off a load of oats that we had harvested in July, and they will be going to human consumption, which is very, very good, rather than to livestock production. And we also added orchard and for apple cider. And we've also included pollinator habitats, prairie. And it's just a totally different feel of stepping outside the door and seeing what we have here. But all around us are the conventional farmers. And actually transitioning in this way in the system that we have is really difficult. And what we do on our farm is just a microcosm of what really needs to be done. I can see we need to transform, we need to totally reimagine our food system, because the farmers that are here, the land that's being used to grow genetically modified corn and soybeans that go to livestock feed, that feed livestock in confinements and feedlots, is not sustainable. It's not resilient. It is not climate friendly, no matter how you try to change the practices. Here in Iowa, there's a big push to for farmers to do no-till, and meaning you limit the amount of tillage that you do, or in fact, do no tillage, which is very friendly to the corporations, because that means genetically modified seeds, so you can spray the fields with herbicides that will kill the weeds, but not the crop. So the idea that we can just change little things about the system is not going to work. What we've done here on our farm is wonderful, but it needs to be replicated across the country and across the world for it to be successful. We can't do things in isolation. One of the things I see here in the United States is that farmers are considered as rugged individuals, and we don't want government involvement. We want to be able to do what we want on our land, and we are the original stewards of the land, the conservationists. Well, that individualism, as we can see in Nicaragua, is not that. That is the example of Nicaragua. They don't think of farmers as being individuals. They work together. Here in the United States, we're much more likely to be independent individuals working on our own farm. So I think what we need to do is really talk about the role of government in our agricultural systems. Government can be a positive and should be a very positive influence on our agricultural systems, rather than seeing it as antagonistic to farming. And that's what a lot of, I would say, the commodity groups, the politicians, kind of promote that idea, that government should stay out of agriculture, out of our lives. And I disagree with that, but government needs to be involved in agriculture because it's so important to everything that we do: climate change, biodiversity, healthy foods, rural communities, farmer livelihoods. So we really need to rethink the role of government in agriculture and our food system. And that's where this UN Food System Summit is not going to produce those kind of changes, I think, that we really need.
Right. I mean, and government is actually involved in our food system through, like, you know, the Farm Act and the subsidies and things like that are given, but that it's not in a way that is actually, I think, what you're trying to get at, which is a more positive, like making sure that we're protecting the farms, that we're making sure we have an adequate food supply, that there's, you know, diversity in the food supply, that it's grown in a way that's good for the planet, good for the even the nutritional value of the food. So what kinds of things, you know, are your organization specifically pushing for the government to do?
Well, my husband and I are involved in a project called Disparity to Parity. During FDR's administration back in the 1930s and 40s, the policy was for parity because he realized how important agriculture was. And of course, the Secretary of Agriculture was a gentleman from Iowa named Henry Wallace. And they put in a program that guaranteed farmers a certain level of price, a price support. And there were certainly some concerns about how that was implemented because of the politics involved. But the idea of a parity price for farmers is very, very important, not just for farmers, but for our whole food system and for consumers and for communities. It's not just about the prices that a farmer receives. But as I said earlier, it's corporations buy our products. And when corporations in this free market system that we have can buy the raw materials like corn, soybeans, and wheat, rice, and other kinds of commodities at such a low price, the corporations are benefiting from that. Subsidies given to farmers encourage or keep in place the low price that the corporations can get. And when it's on a global scale, that means that they can find the lowest price anywhere around the world. So what we believe needs to happen, and that would be not so much a radical reform because it's happened before, but it would be a radical change of how we look at farming today, because we are not looking at it in this kind of model, but a support price for farmers, including, and it has to be tied to supply management, which means we wouldn't be growing as many corn and soybean acres as we do currently, would mean getting livestock back on the land. And it would also mean that we would have grain reserves, food reserves, which is incredibly important when it comes to climate change and the extreme weather events that we're having, drought and flooding. The government would have control of food reserves. So these are very, very important aspects of an agricultural policy that would really change how we grow our food and who's on the land. And it would need to be an international policy as well, though, because right now, price supports, supply management, grain reserves can't really be done as long as the World Food Trade Organization has the rules in place that it has. That means that countries cannot put tariffs on imports to protect their own farmers. If there was, for instance, if we had the price that supported our farmers, but another country was able to produce and sell a crop for a lower price, we would not want that to come into our country because it would take away the market for our farmers. So we need to be able to, each country needs to be able to support their own farmers. Right now in India, the farmers have been protesting there now for, I believe it's 9 months, against 3 new laws that were put in place by the Modi government that takes away those kind of price supports. I think I saw on the news just a few days ago, yesterday or the day before, nearly 1 million people gathered in support of these farmers. Farmers and others were gathering. That's a huge, huge show of support and shows how the price of the farmers receive and the support of the government to keep that in place is so very, very important that these farmers know that if they are not being supported by their government and the corporations have the ability to set prices through the global free market system, they know that their time on the land is limited, is in jeopardy. So what's happening in India, I think, is an incredibly important thing to pay attention to as well.
Yeah, it is inspiring. And I understand that they've been occupying a space just outside of Delhi. You know, it is very much like, kind of reminds me of the Occupy movement, where they have their own kitchens and their own education and, you know, media and things that they're doing there. It's not getting a lot of attention globally, but it's really incredible resistance that they're showing there. So there is also a radical history in the United States. You talked about some of those changes that happened under FDR, but I think that was also around the time that farmers were really kind of banding together, forming cooperatives, making agreements to use their collective power to influence, you know, the government policies. Is that something that you have any familiarity with?
We do have on the website of our project, Disparity to Parity, does have a section on a history of the parity principles. And I think that would be a good place for people to go and look. But certainly the farm crisis of the 1980s is still fresh in a lot of people's minds, where a lot of farmers lost their farms. Families now, people my age can remember remember the heartbreak it was when they had to leave the farm, because living and working on a farm is a very personal thing. It's not just like a, it's not just a job that you can go and change whenever you want. It's your, it's where you live. It's also your livelihood. And currently the dairy farmers in the United States and other places, especially, but here in the United States are in heartbreaking situations. Dairy farmers are, in a sense, really, really important aspect of our food system. Dairy cows are generally on pasture, and that pasture is an important part of keeping the soil healthy, keeping carbon sequestered. If you're concerned about climate change and soil health, we need to have more small dairies on pasture rather than the big mega dairies that are coming into play now and putting these small dairies out of business. And dairy cows are part of the family. When a family farm has to go out of business because their prices are so low and they have to sell off those cows, it is an incredibly heartbreaking situation. I just can't imagine what that's like for people. My own family, we had dairy cows when I was a kid, and it was a daily commitment to take care of those animals. And my brother continued to milk dairy cows up until the mid-1990s. But at this point, here where I am, there's no way that I could, on our farm, that we could have dairy cows because there's no place to sell the milk. All of the small processing plants that were in place have disappeared. They've consolidated into bigger ones. And so if you want to have dairy cows now and produce milk, you need to be in the right place, or you need to have your own processing facility, which is, of course, very expensive.
So when you were talking about dairy, it reminded me how early in the pandemic, we were seeing stories of dairy farmers in Vermont that were literally dumping their milk. And at the same time that I was reading those stories, I was, you know, hearing from communities in Baltimore City where I live who were unable to get food because despite the fact that the state put in place an anti-price gouging law, the stores around their community were raising the price of eggs and milk and other basic staples, you know, doubling and tripling those prices. And so they were struggling to get food. And that's what a capitalist food system looks like, right? As opposed
right.
to one in Nicaragua that actually makes sure that people can get food, or Venezuela, where they give people, you know, food through the CLAP program once or twice a month.
Right. So the pandemic, especially when it hit so quickly for us back in the spring of 2020, it really highlighted the fragility, the vulnerability of our food system. When we have such a complex food chain, and I say complex, it means it's not flexible. There was no flexibility in getting the food to people. A lot of the food that was dumped would generally have gone to restaurants, and people weren't going to restaurants anymore. So part of it was the fact that food wasn't packaged in a way that could be set on a grocery store shelf. Here in Iowa, I think we are the number one egg producer in the country, or pretty close to it. But most of the eggs that we produce, meaning corporations, go to liquid eggs that go to restaurants and in institutions. So it shows that the supply chain that we have is not flexible. If we have more crises in the future, that's something that really needs to be focused on. That's why more regional food hubs, decentralized food supplies, I think makes more sense. At least part of our food supply needs to be in that way.
Right. That flexibility, that democratization of the system so that it can respond to the various crises that we are facing and that we will continue to face. So how can people who are interested in this learn more? What are the best websites? How can they plug into what's happening around the Food Summit on the 23rd?
There's a couple of websites, certainly National Family Farm Coalition's website. U.S. Food Sovereignty Alliance has a website. Certainly go to both of those through social media. But also the Global Resistance, the Global Countermobilization has our website also, which has the videos from the pre-summit countermobilization, and that is foodsystemsforpeople.org. And the four is the number four, foodsystemsforpeople.org. Has a lot of resources and videos and webinars, and it's very, very inspiring. And this is something we need to pay attention to even after September 23rd, when the food system summit occurs. We still will have plenty of work to do, plenty of analysis and mobilizations again, I'm sure.
Well, Patty, I want to thank you for the important work that you're doing. Food is really fundamental, and food sovereignty and agroecology are issues that we really need to be aware of and supporting, you know, more development of that here in the United States. We didn't talk about the whole education piece, which is another part that needs to be addressed in the United States as well, making sure that these practices are taught, that people, you know, are able to implement them. Thank you so much for taking time to speak with me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that's all for today. You've been listening to Clearing the Fog, Speaking Truth to Expose the Forces of Greed on Pacifica Radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. Pacifica Radio is listener sponsored. If you like what you heard today, consider becoming a Clearing the Fog buddy by making a monthly donation to WBAI.org. Even a few dollars a month helps to keep us on the air. I'm Margaret Flowers. I'll go out with a song by Junkyard Empire. It's called We Want.
And you're tuned to 99.5 FM, WBAI, WBAI.org. It's 11:55, and coming up next, we have some headline news.
From WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Tuesday, September 14th. Here are some headlines. Hurricane Nicholas, now a tropical storm, made landfall along the Texas coast early today. Widespread rainfall of 5 to 10 inches is predicted from the upper Texas coast through central and southern Louisiana, and for far southern Mississippi and Alabama. Up to 20 inches are possible in the hardest hit areas as the storm slows to a crawl and unloads heavy rain for up to 36 hours in some locations. More than 500,000 homes and businesses were without power in southeast Texas, including the Houston area, as of late Tuesday morning, according to PowerOutage.us. The fate of California Governor Gavin Newsom hangs in the balance today as millions of Californians cast votes in a recall election over his policies and leadership. If a majority votes no on the recall question, Newsom will remain governor. If 50% plus one vote yes, then he will be ousted as governor, and the candidate who receives the most votes on the second question will serve the remainder of Newsom's term until January 2023. Larry Elder is the top polling Republican among those vying to replace Newsom, and there are questions about how willing Elder will be to accept the results of today's vote if Newsom survives. Elder already has begun to support an emerging narrative pushed by major Fox News personalities that claims Governor Newsom will only win the recall because of election fraud, despite the lack of any credible evidence. Senate Democrats are expected to introduce a compromise voting rights bill today based on the sweeping For the People Act and the principles put forward by conservative Democrat Joe Manchin. The Freedom to Vote Act requires states to allow at least 15 days of early voting, ensure access to mail ballots, and establish automatic voter registration programs. The bill avoids some of the more contentious elements of the For the People Act, such as the restructuring of the Federal Election Commission. It also creates a national voter ID standard, something many Democrats have opposed. Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar, a co-sponsor of the new bill, said it would set basic national standards to make sure all Americans can cast their ballots in the way that works best for them regardless of what zip code they live in. Republicans appear to be united in their opposition to the bill, despite the compromises forced by Senator Manchin. And COVID-19 vaccine boosters are not needed at this time for the general public, according to an expert review of scientific evidence to date. A group of leading U.S. and international scientists said yesterday in the peer-reviewed journal The Lancet that whatever the advantage boosters provide would not outweigh the benefit of using those doses to inoculate the billions of people who remain unvaccinated worldwide. The 18 authors include Dr. Philip Krause and Dr. Marion Gruber, FDA scientists who announced last month they would be leaving the agency in part because they disagreed with the Biden administration's push for boosters before federal scientists could review the evidence and make recommendations. A committee of advisors to the FDA is scheduled to meet on Friday to review the data. And in weather today, in Washington, D.C., it is 81 degrees.